Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the KE Report Weekend Show. Corey and Shad here, your host for this weekend edition, also your host on our website, kereport.com, and podcasts. Just search the KE Report in your podcast player to listen to all our daily editorials of market commentary throughout the week, as well as company updates that we posted throughout the week. On this weekend show, we're going to be sticking to resources and commodities in the first half of the show. We're going to be focusing on the metals sector. Back half of the show, time to move over to energy in the oil and gas sector, all tying it into really how to invest heading into next year, some of the key themes, and maybe even a couple companies sprinkled in. We're kicking off the show with Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Joe, it's pretty much the end of the year, so let's give a quick little review of what happened in the metals sector, especially precious metals. Overall, it was a good year for gold and silver especially. A lot of other metals were mixed, but again, at worst, maybe sideways movement in a lot of these metals. Choppy, that's for sure. Gold up about 30% this year. Silver up about 40% this year. GDX up about 30%. GDXJ up over 35%. SIL is up over 40% this year. So again, overall, Joe, it's a pretty good year for precious metals. We're still hearing a lot of CEOs complaining about the market, though. So, Joe, from your standpoint, the newsletter writer standpoint, and the investor standpoint, what's your takeaway from 2024?
Well, if we stick to precious metals as a theme, you know, obviously, as you said, gold has done well. And probably earlier in the year, as we mentioned off air, it was being supported by central bank purchases when interest rates were looking to be flat to, you know, real rates were probably going up at that point. And then when those central bank purchases, specifically from the Chinese, ended in the summer, then the realization or the expectation that there might be a significant cut in interest rates in September brought ETF buying back in, specifically US. And what's positive about US buying equity, gold equity ETFs, is that is money that seeps into equity ETFs. So that when they're buying the gold ETFs, or some of that funds will sink into equity ETFs, which supported the GDX, GDXJ going into September. And then we had the geopolitical crisis. And so that was also an underpinning of for the gold price. But then when the interest right now with the incoming administration, you know, there's an idea that maybe all these wars are going to be over. So maybe some of that geopolitical crisis or risk comes back off. Although now we just had the Syria incident just recently. But now what we're having is the Chinese coming and buying again back in November. It looks like they're back in the market. So for me, I guess when you look at this year, a lot of fortuitous multiple sources of buying for gold that kept it going up, kept that balloon in the air, basically. Either the breath was being blown by the Chinese buying gold from the central banks, or it was gold ETF buying by the US institutions in anticipation of lower interest rates or low real rates. And then geopolitical crisis, that would get people into buying physical gold. But also, I would say, another thing would have been, you know, buying by Chinese retail as well, because as their economy has been sort of, I mean, floundering for them, you know, we have a lot more demand from them in terms of the hold of value. So again, multiple sources of value sort of support for gold, which has been positive and led to, you know, it's outperformed lift this year. And then silver, you know, leverage, showing its leverage. And I think some of that as well is driven by the supply side, because, you know, silver is much more a marginal cost industry than gold, but it's also got the issue with byproducts. But what we're seeing is because of what's happening in Mexico, you know, which is one of the biggest producers of silver, is that people are worried that there might not be, you know, enough silver dominant assets out there that might be developed if Mexico is not very pro mining, which, you know, under the new president will just continue the sort of anti-mining legislations of the previous president, which was AMLO. So yeah, that's basically my summary for gold and silver. And as we said, base metals more mixed. I'm still, you know, big into copper, but because of the more moderate Chinese economy, you know, that those markets haven't been particularly buoyant. But I think on the supply side, as we look at M&A and that, you know, industry knows the issues with copper and the lack of an incentive price to develop, which will just make a bigger springboard for copper going forward. So I'm still bullish on copper despite the Chinese weakness. I know China is bringing out some stimulus packages, which before the end of the year might help. And then, but the other overhang we have is this potential imposition of tariffs. What's that going to do to the global economy? What's that going to do to Chinese consumption of commodities? So yeah, a lot to take in, you know, at the end of the year.
Well, Joe, I think that's a great synopsis of the metals, gold, silver, and copper. Let's dive into some of the gold and silver equities, though. It was kind of a mixed year in the equities. There was definitely companies that did well, that blasted to new highs. There were some companies that at least had an upward trend, but maybe on par or even lower than what we saw in the metals prices. And there were still a lot of juniors that really didn't have as much action. So it was a tale of the haves and the have-nots. What are your main takeaways as far as the different areas of the gold and silver equities?
Well, I find that the ones that have done very well have been, you know, underlying outstanding assets and management, like Alamos has done very well. And then also Lundin, they have a high margin asset in Ecuador. That's done very well. But other companies that have not done so well have had issues with their underlying assets, with the costs going up, or geopolitical issues like in West Africa. So those can be problematic, as we've seen, you know, with Mali putting out an arrest warrant for Mark Bristow and that. So people are now rewarding highly assets that are in geopolitically benign jurisdictions. And if you add on high margin assets, you know, that's where the weight of the investors are tending to lean.
Yeah, that's been the trend in M&A too, is higher margin assets and even those that are built. Joe, does that change in this environment? Does money start to filter down into more of these exploration plays? Or are we going to continue to be in this environment where companies see it being cheaper, more effective to buy ounces in the ground rather than actually discover them?
Well, yeah, exploration, grassroots exploration in most commodities has been going down. And, you know, part of the reason is because the juniors that try to do it are not getting funded as much. So that's been an issue in terms of grassroots. But if you are a intermediate or a major producer, you're trying to avoid the issues with permitting, and you're trying to avoid the issues with capital escalation by buying production and not caring if you have to pay a premium for it.
Well, Joe, when you look at some of the M&A that we've seen go on, we have seen a lot of production assets scooped up to be bolt-on operations, maybe help a company's jurisdictional profile and or just their overall cost basis. But we did see a lot. I mean, we saw a lot of M&A this year. We did see a lot of companies combine into mergers where there were development companies merging with development companies. And we did see some high profile takeovers like Gold Fields going after Osisko Mining, or Calibre going after Marathon, Filo getting scooped up by BHP and London Mining. So do we think we see more of that in 2025? Some of these developers getting picked off?
Well, that's my hope. And that's a hope of a lot of the developers that are sitting there trying to find funding for their project and hoping to get picked out. But, you know, some of that issue has been like with B2 Gold buying Sabina, the Goose Lake project, that capital has kept increasing and the costs have kept going up. So even though buying the company to acquire the asset looks accretive, The problem is actually when you get into building it, how accretive is that? And so that's, I think, well, some people will still be wary of those kind of projects because they'll want to know the capital number, how good it is. So the study has to be good and they have to believe it. And so somebody who puts out a PEA with a really nice number with a 40% IRR, you know, that's going to get looked at a lot. Even though retail might think, well, this is a great project, somebody from outside might say those numbers are all wrong, you know, and it's not going to look like that. So they just sit on their hands with projects like that. So I think that, yeah, the, you know, development projects or advanced exploration projects like we saw Reunion Gold's Oko West, a high quality deposit, open pittable, Guyana. You know, that got bought by G Mining. So those kind of assets, you know, I think will be the ones that get acquired in terms of development assets. But then as we look geopolitically, you know, are we going to see M&A in West Africa? I don't know. You know, because I think that a lot of these guys overexposed to West Africa might be doing M&A, but they might not be doing it in West Africa.
Joe, I find this to be one of the most important topics for the sector, for the underlying precious metals equities, and not just from this last year, but over the last number of years, where there are so many defined resources out there all around the world, all with different profiles. And we keep hearing how there haven't been new discoveries. Discoveries are have dropped off the table in the last decade. But my argument is we still have all these other assets that were discovered decades ago that are still around. Companies are slowly working them up, and everybody has their hand out for money, saying, look, this is going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Our market cap is nowhere near that price tag. So how are we going to go about funding it? And again, the majors don't seem to be taking those risks to go and build some of these assets. So what's going to change for the developers here, which, in all fairness, I feel like there are almost just as many developers as there are explorers now.
No, you're right. But some of these projects have been, like you said, around for a while. And it seems like no matter what the gold price is, they never make any money and nobody wants to build them. So it's
Well, the
almost like
argument
those.
is now they should make money. Look at how high the gold price is. Everything should make money. But again, there's so many of them.
Yeah, but argument is made by only changing one component of the valuation, which is the gold price. A lot of them don't change the operating costs or the capital, which have gone up. And so if you look at the study, look at what date it is. If it's pre-COVID, it really does not hold any water. It's going to have to be a post-COVID study. And so, you know, that's what people are looking at. And the other problem is permitting, you know, how long these projects take to permit. And so if you're looking as in terms of an M&A and you want to make, you know, an accretive acquisition, you know, and you're unsure as to the social license to operate to permit something, you might well prefer something that's already in production with no capital risk, you know, and I can see exactly why these companies are buying operating assets. Like Newmont, they've been divesting after their, you know, merger with Newcrest. And now they're being able to actively sell assets. Why? Because most of these are operating assets. So, you know, they sold Akyem to, I believe, Zijin. They just sold their Colorado asset to the SSR Mining, which is trying to diversify themselves out of the hassle they have in Turkey. So there's buyers out there, but they're first going for the producing asset. Then they'll go for the high quality asset, meaning the development asset. But high quality means not only margin, but it also means geopolitically, you know, benign jurisdiction, something with so no social license to operate issues, something with access to water, all this sort of stuff, ticking all those boxes. If it doesn't tick those boxes, it's not getting it acquired.
Well, Joe, as we look back at 2024 in Canada and in gold, it was kind of a big year for three big mines getting built. We saw Greenstone get built by Equinox. We saw Côté finally get built and into production from IAMGOLD. And we saw Magino get built, although it was a messy process by Argonaut, only to be taken over by Alamos that you mentioned earlier in this call. So it's a big year for big Canadian mines, but you made a great point off mic to us that when you look at some of the other mines that are in construction, not just in gold, but when you look at copper, when you look at uranium, and some of the big projects on the table, it's probably going to require foreign investment capital. And there's been some challenges with Canada and foreign investment capital coming in. I'd love you to maybe unpack that a little bit further for some of the deals. And you mentioned Solaris as kind of an area we could look at as far as a workaround to this process.
Yeah, so Solaris has a project in Ecuador earlier, I think this year. Zijin Mining was going to put a big investment in them to help them advance the project. The Canadian government slow walked that to the point that Solaris decided to pull themselves out of that process. They did another financing, but they knew, and the end game was with a Chinese suitor. There was no Western suitor that was going to take that project. So to make that happen, then they basically had to redomicile themselves, change management, and have no employees in Canada. I think they're still TSX listed, so I don't know all the legal impacts from what they're doing, but I'm gathering they paid a lot of lawyers to know what they're doing. And so their whole idea is that they could create an entity that is investable by the Chinese without having to ask the Canadian government for permission. So I would think that other companies that are dealing with especially critical mineral assets with Chinese involvement, where there is no other suitor, they would be looking to probably in the end go down a similar path. And we've seen other issues with even some gold projects as well, which doesn't make much sense to me in terms of how that works. But yeah, I would definitely be talking to companies that are in these sort of jurisdictions where the Chinese bid is superior to the Western bid, that they would have to look at a path like Solaris in terms of to get to their end game, which might be an acquisition.
Government's getting in the way, hey Joe. But that's kind of par for the course for the mining sector. How does that tie into then permitting? You've mentioned permitting a couple of times, but boy, oh boy, I felt like this whole year, all companies were talking about was permitting. And quite frankly, it's a slow process, and there's not much companies can say until a permit is released, other than, hey, we think we're going to get it. And then on the back end of that, governments, are they going to be more supportive of some sort of mining, even if it is outside of precious metals, more in the critical minerals space? What do you want to take there?
Well, I mean, the S&P Global Market Intelligence came up with this graphic of data about discovery to production. And so they said for copper, it's about 18 years, 16 to 18 years from discovery to production, which seems like a long time. And so that's why I'm so bullish on copper, because if we don't know the project right now, there's no way it's filling any gap in 2027, 2028. So if we go back to that, so I was just in Peru at a conference down there, as well as conducting a couple site visits. I looked at a project called Quellaveco, which is a big copper project that just reached commercial production in 2022, operated by Anglo American. That project was discovered in the 60s, and it was acquired by Anglo American in 1992. So 30 years after it was acquired, it went into commercial production. And that's a project with a big footprint, and it's in Peru. Not all the issues with it taking 30 years were Peru. There's corporate, there's COVID, there's a whole bunch of other things that meshed into that to generate that 30-year timeline. But that's probably more the typical timeline nowadays for these big footprint projects that would make a dent in the market.
Well, Joe, let's dig into copper even further because I know it's an interest of yours. It's an interest of our listeners. There are some higher profile advanced exploration development projects now emerging in British Columbia, in Arizona in particular, in the United States, in Alaska. Some of them have been stalled for a while. Some of them are making progress. And then there's, of course, all of the South American projects. Do you think that there's enough projects slated to come online in the next couple of years that we really do fill that gap? Is there anything to all of the noise and the chest beating about the supply deficit in copper and any projects that really have your eyes actually getting to the finish line?
I would say the copper risk, copper price risk, meaning that, you know, that it might waver or go down, which I don't think about, is on the demand side. So does demand growth grow at 2%, 2.5% compound annual growth rate, or is it like 1 to 1.5%? You know, a lot of that growth was driven by carbon neutral technologies. Does that continue at the same pace or does it accelerate? So that's for me a bigger risk than the supply side, I don't think can fill any gap. Just because of everything, we talked about permitting, we talked about water issues, and also capital risk. Because the problem right now is that after Quebrada Blanca 2, how much money Teck spent on building that project and how far wrong they got their own capital estimates. Some of it was COVID, some of it was just building a project in that environment. You know, in the end, it was like an $8.6 billion project, I believe. And this was supposedly brownfields. It's not brownfields because they're completely changing the mine plan, but it's a modification of a permit, which is easier to do in Chile than it is to start a new one. But that's what's scaring a lot of people to build new project is they don't think that the price right now of copper is high enough to incentivize them to build. So if, you know, we're talking about, you know, $4.50, but some people are talking about, you know, $5 plus to make people trigger a decision, you know? And so that's why a lot of people are talking about, well, the copper price has got to move because there's no incentive to build anything.
I feel like we've heard that before, Joe. And while that is a valid argument, I don't know how often price actually does follow that, at least in the short term. There's a lot of other factors that obviously play into price outside of what it is to incentivize companies to build. Let's take a little step back now and talk about some recent site visits you were on, a trip down into South America. You were in Argentina and Peru. Look, a lot of the focus in, I guess, south of the border in the U.S. has been in Mexico with the new president. We'll see what changes, if anything changes with that new administration. But Argentina, boy, oh boy, there's been a lot of positive news coming out of Argentina on the mining front. What's your takeaway from Argentina now that you've just returned from that trip?
Well, Argentina has been positive. So the federal government does not control mining. The provinces control mining. So if the federal government, which has improved and put in incentives for large investments, if that, which it has passed, that's highly positive for the states or the provinces that like mining, which would be Salta, Jujuy, and now the southern part of Mendoza, San Juan, and Santa Cruz, and even Catamarca. So, but those provinces that don't like mining or are anti-mining, that doesn't change anything because the provinces still control that resource. But what I've seen is the ones that do like mining, their ability to accelerate development in that is good. And so what's happening now in Mendoza is that these guys are coming down and saying, okay, well, we found a place in southern Mendoza called Malargue, which, you know, Mendoza was always pretty negative on mining since I was there in the 90s. But now what they've done is the government has done the social license to operate in advance for the companies. And so right now they're promoting mining in a certain jurisdiction where they can get away with it, where they have social license to operate, they have access to water. And so when companies come in and raise money, they can do it, no problems. They can go straight in and start drilling, which I think that sort of what they're doing is something other people should look at emulating. So as opposed to forcing the junior company, which is capital constraint and needs to raise money, and they might not be drilling for 2 years because they have to do social license to operate stuff, you know, let the government do that. Let the government tell them where they can go. And then when they do get that, they can go straight in and fund exploration and development. I mean, development meaning drilling, as opposed to waiting for 2 years like some companies have waited in Peru.
Well, it's also been interesting in Argentina to see at the federal level them change those RIGI laws where it helps with export duties by year three, there aren't any, and then also reduces the taxing from 35% down to 25% for companies that qualify the next couple of years with development projects. That's a big boon economically to those companies. But let's talk Peru because you were also just on site visits down in Peru. Peru's been kind of a political roller coaster the last 2 decades, but where are things in the here and now? Is it a good area to be investing in for mining projects?
Well, endowment is why people will take the risk on Peru. There's no denying the endowment of, polymetallic deposits that are world class in Peru. The problem has been infrastructure, which that problem has existed for more than a decade, and there has been no reinvestment in that. Another problem is bureaucracy because of, how many governments or presidents they've gone through in the last 8 years. They haven't had somebody go through a full 5-year term since Humala did. So whenever you change a president, you change all the bureaucracy underneath it, and that changes how things get permitted in that and what people are emphasizing. And that's been a huge hassle for juniors trying to drill down there. They're trying to get through that backlog, but in the interim, in the last, like during PDAC, I think they got rid of a mining minister, and then just recently when I was down there, they got rid of another mining minister. So they really need to solidify that position and ensure that people can get their permits. The other problem that they have is that they have an issue with informal mining. And so there's other people that come in there and just start mining. And so these guys are mining without any permits and no surface rights, and they're not paying taxes. And this wasn't a big deal in the 90s when I was there, but over the last couple of decades, it's becoming a bigger thing. When I was down there, they were having a lot of, discussions about that law that they put forward because there was so much illegal mining. Some of it funds criminal activity, but a lot of it doesn't pay taxes. No license to operate sometimes with the local communities. But on the other hand, sometimes the community's on the take and they're getting paid by these illegals. So, for the junior or for the developer or the major company, they're looking at, well, why do I have to run through all these hoops of 2 years just to drill when these guys can just walk in and start mining? So that's something they definitely have to resolve.
Joe, how quickly can countries resolve this kind of stuff? I know Argentina, they go up and down, it seems like every about 5 to 7 years, and they turn right on a dime within a year or two. Peru, though, it seems like we've been dealing with these issues, permitting, for quite a while now. Is this a multi-year transition that Peru needs to go through, or could it all turn, let's say, within a year?
Yeah, this current president has the lowest approval rating in the world globally, so less than 5%. And mining could be doing a lot better under this administration, but it's moving forward just because of endowment and, just critical momentum. But I think if they switch in the next presidential elections, we could see a big change. But they would need a lot of foreign direct investment to come in to help them with the infrastructure. And so what you've had recently, while I was down there right before, they had the APEC summit. And then with that Asia Pacific summit, the Chinese president was there. And he inaugurated with the current president of Peru a new port facility, a multi-billion dollar port facility 40 or 50 miles north of Peru, Lima. And so that port facility is not only to take goods out of Peru and avoid the, Panama Canal, but also potentially, if the infrastructure is there, to take stuff out of Brazil. And both those countries, their major export destination is China. We're seeing the Chinese, start coming back and spending a lot more money on exterior investments right now to help their own economy and help their own supply chain.
Well, Joe, while we're down in South America, you brought up Brazil. That's had a lot of activity this year. We saw a lot in Guyana, Ecuador, Chile. Any other countries that you really like or countries that you're avoiding in South America?
Well, I'm still not sure about Ecuador, the criminal activity there, and then the power infrastructure there is still a bit of an issue. But I do like Lundin Gold. I mean, they've done very well, and they've got very high margin asset that they keep reinvesting in it. And A problem with a high margin asset in a geopolitically risky area is how do you acquire anything accretive? What they've been doing is reinvesting that in exploration in their own, where they know where they are and what they're doing. And they've been able to grow their asset. And so I think that's worked out very well. So that's a company that's worked well in a geopolitically risky jurisdiction, but also under adverse conditions as well.
All right, Joe, we'll wrap it up here. Again, Joe Mazumdar, our editor of Exploration Insights. Joe, it's always so interesting to hear what you're seeing in this market. You've been around for a while, and you always take a very level-headed approach to analyzing individual companies and assessing overall market environment. So, Joe, again, great having you on the weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.